This is part two of our mold exposure episode with Amy Skilton. In this episode, we cover supplements for acute exposure, what to clean mold with, what should be saved, and what to consider when you are dealing with mold, and also we touch on water health. A space for conversation around women's health through the lens of naturopathic and Eastern medicine. I am Sandy Ross, and this is Her Earth Medicine Podcast. This podcast is multi-leveled. Episodes for patient education to graduate practitioner level. Thank you for tuning in, and I hope you gain value from this episode. So I understand what you're saying. It's obviously best to work with a GP or someone that is familiar with working with mold illness and understands the complexity of it. However, if someone might have just been cleaning the last couple of weeks and they've definitely been exposed to mold and they might start having some acute symptoms, what are some of the things we could recommend as a go-to, you know, a few supplements potentially or things they can eat? What could we start to support these people with?
Yes, okay. So it sort of depends on the symptoms you're getting, but like all other toxins, the body has organs that detoxify these things for us and eliminate them typically through the bile and the urine. So a couple of things I would say is obviously stay well hydrated, which, you know, can be a bit tricky at the moment because I know with the water being contaminated, there's a water shortage, all kinds of things have been happening here, which have made that difficult. But all of our toxins are eliminated via that fluid, whether it's urine coming out through the kidneys, bile coming out through from the liver and out through the bowel, even sweating and also moisture vapor on the breath. So the more we can keep our fluids up, the more we can support that. The second thing would be we've got an opportunity in the gut to limit how much gets reabsorbed. So like anything the liver eliminates into the gut, we can see enterohepatic recirculation. And so there are lots of fibres that, so in simply increasing your fibrous fruit and vegetable intake is going to allow more sponge in the gut to absorb those toxins and have them pass out through your stool. There are some that might be better than others, like if you can access stewed apples, that would be the pectin fiber in apples is really lovely, also very gentle on the gut. And I know some people might struggle with certain types of fiber, especially if they've had chronic gut things already. But there are binders typically when, you know, we're treating someone with mold exposure, especially with SIRS, and it's like a bit of a slow burn trying to pull those toxins out, we would recommend binders. Now there are pharmaceutical binders and they are the strongest that you can get. However, you do need a prescription, which means you need to be working with a SIRS literate GP. The downside to a strong binder too is as it's sort of vacuuming out toxins really powerfully, it can actually make you feel worse initially. You've got to be quite careful. And at the moment, while everyone's in crisis mode trying to fix things, no one needs to feel worse than they already do. So I feel confident in saying start with some really gentle binders and start really low dose. And my two favourites would be activated charcoal. Now, most people are probably familiar with activated charcoal. It's used in other forms of poisoning in the hospital. People use it for food poisoning. It also can absorb gas. Carbon, it's a source of carbon, and we, of course, use carbon filters to filter out contaminants in water as well. So that would be great. Bear in mind, all binders are going to absorb water, and so you do need to increase your fluid intake when you take binders to avoid getting constipated. If they start to block you up, either lower the dose or increase your water intake. But I think activated charcoal is probably going to be the most user-friendly and the most accessible and probably the most cost-effective, I think. Now, some mycotoxins have more of an affinity for certain binders than others. And so typically, you know, if we're treating someone naturopathically for this, we would use a combination. So there's a couple of others that are recommended. activated cell wall chlorella is also a really nice sponge for toxins. It does need to be cracked cell wall in order to get that benefit. And ideally you would go for organic just to avoid potentially any other contaminants. But honestly, cracked cell wall chlorella of any nature, if I was in the position that that's all I had access to, I would definitely take that. Also, zeolites are really powerful for absorbing contaminants, including heavy metals. So what I would say about that, though, is use a, what's the word I'm looking for? One that's been manufactured to pharmaceutical grade. And what I mean by that is you can buy zeolite clay and bentonite clay very easily in bags over the counter. However, I'd be asking for the certificate of analysis first. Now, that probably sounds very technical, but the reason I'm saying this is because those minerals themselves are so powerful at attracting toxins. If you don't have a good quality powder, you might actually just be ingesting toxins that it's actually absorbed from its original environment. So using one that's been manufactured specifically, I think, is really important. In the past, I've used ToxiPrevent, and that worked really well for me. So, yeah, you could use a combination of those things if you want, or even just one of those things if that's all you can get. And I feel like activated charcoal is probably the most accessible.
In the meantime, while people are trying to source them, if they can't get the charcoal, could they use things like even psyllium husk, something that's super gentle? Yeah, okay. I practiced in Bangkok, and I just have to say this. They were growing spirulina. They had a spirulina farm growing on one of the rooftops of this polluted city, yes. And I know, and I was like, oh, I'm not too sure about that, because it's just pulling it in. It's pulling everything in from the environment. It's not in those beautiful Hawaiian grown areas. So, yeah, people do definitely need to check the source. So very, very good point there. So that's great. You've touched on binders, which are very, very important. Is there any antioxidants or gentle liver support that you could recommend, immune support in the meantime? Yes.
Yeah, so this one again is a little bit tricky, because mycotoxins block a pathway in the body called NRF2, and we don't need to get nerdy about that, but what it means is strong antioxidants can actually can backfire initially when you're still being exposed. So there's sort of two things that I would suggest while someone's still cleaning up their stuff from the mold, from the flood, sorry, and still being exposed, is just to use two very safe and gentle options. So my favorite is liposomal glutathione. So any glutathione would be good. I do know there's a brand that makes a capsule that has proven bioavailability, and glutathione is like one of our master antioxidants and supports phase 1, phase 2, and phase 3 detox. And the reason that's important is you don't need to understand the physiology of it necessarily, but if you think about like a production line of, say, garbage coming in and it goes through 3 different processes before it comes out, you want each of those production lines to be working at the same pace. Otherwise, you're going to get a traffic jam in the middle. And so certain amazing herbs and other antioxidants that target just one of those production lines can actually dysregulate the whole thing very quickly while you're still being overloaded, whereas glutathione helps just support all 3 of them and speed them up, but allows them to work in harmony with each other. So glutathione, amazing. Liposomal glutathione, way more amazing if you can get it. The only thing is it does need to be kept cool, and if you don't have access to refrigeration, you might need to keep it on ice in an esky bin or ask someone else to keep it cold for you, because otherwise it can degrade. But liposomal gives you at least 100-fold better delivery on the actual compound itself, and also the phospholipids that it's delivered in the actual liposome helps to repair cell membranes that have been inflamed as well. So I think, and also specifically help with liver detox too. So I really love that. I wouldn't use it without a binder, because what can happen is you end up sort of moving toxins out of the liver into the gut, and then they just get reabsorbed, and that can make you feel more unwell. So binder first, if you can only pick one, get the binder. But if you can do both, you'll feel so much better. I know when I was getting headaches from mold, liposomal products should be held under the tongue for 1 to 2 minutes, FYI, before you swallow. And I know when I would hold liposomal glutathione under my tongue, within 30 to 60 seconds, I could feel my headache just starting to drain away. It was so powerful.
Yeah.
So they would be my favorite things. The other thing I would say is milk thistle, a herb called milk thistle, also known as St. Mary's thistle, is just the most, it's like a hug to your liver. It's got lovely antioxidant profile, but again, it helps to keep phase 1, 2, and 3 working in harmony, and it also protects the liver against poisons. And it's been clinically trialed against different poisons, but we know it has this global effect on helping protect the liver from exposure to things that are problematic. So that would be sort of the first things that I would go to. And I feel like almost everyone would be feel really good on that and wouldn't have a problem on that. And then from there, obviously, depending on what symptoms they've got, I'd add other things. But yeah, just generally speaking, that's the way to go.
Okay, that's a great start. I guess one positive of COVID, if we can say that, is that a lot of people have been on kind of immune protocols. They've been doing the zinc and the vitamin D, quercetin, which is great for the inflammation. And a lot of people have been taking NAC. So that's a precursor for our glutathione. So hopefully everyone has done a lot of immune support. So if they are being exposed, they're less likely to develop those chronic symptoms. Can I ask, cleaning? I have seen things going around. I know it can be super, where do we go? What should we be using to clean the mold? Yeah. What can we do to protect ourselves?
Yes. Okay. So this is a big subject, and actually, I'll send you across the link. There was a great free webinar done by Nicole Belsma, who's head of the Building Biology College, Australian College of Environmental Studies, and Dr. Sandeep Gupta, who was the first GP in Australia to become Shoemaker trained and SIRS and mould literate. And they go into a bit more detail. I'm just mindful of time. But I guess the key points I want to highlight are is you can't kill mould. So mould's effects on our health have very little to do with whether it's alive or dead. It's the particulate matter, and it's also the mycotoxins. And 75% of mould doesn't actually proliferate anyway. It's already dead. And so the issue with that not only is it's ineffective, but when you try and kill living mold, it produces even more biotoxins, which are of course the most dangerous part of mold exposure. Now there are enzymes that can help degrade mycotoxins, sure, and they can be used strategically in certain cases, but what I am seeing, and it's very distressing knowing that this is not the way to go, is people offering, you know, chemical fogging. And there is one type of fogging that can be used safely as, if you like, to polish the air after appropriate remediation has been done, but it does not constitute remediation in any way, shape or form. So rather than killing mold, you have to remove it and remove it entirely. You need to think a little bit like a noxious weed. You've got to pull it out by the roots. And so the reason I'm giving that analogy is if you've got mold growing on your walls, so like the plasterboard in your house, you can't clean it off the surface of the plasterboard and consider it gone. Its hyphae have, its roots have embedded into the plasterboard, and it's going to sit there and it's going to continue to grow and reappear and reappear and produce mycotoxins for as long as that material remains. And so if you've got any mold growing on porous items, meaning items that can absorb water, those things have to be discarded. So let's say you were flooded, the water came into your house up to waist height, for instance, or knee height, whatever the case may be. Now, I know for some people, their house, entire houses went under, but I'm sharing this just to let you know how water can move in a building. Via capillary traction, water can actually travel against gravity, like up porous materials up to a meter.
Wow.
And so if your house got flooded to knee height, you actually have to cut out the plasterboard to a meter above where the water line was. So that's got to go, especially if it was exposed to black water or category 3 water. So it's a little bit different if the water came in and disappeared within an hour, and then you got the plasterboard dry in 12 to 24 hours. You'd probably have an issue with wet insulation in the walls, and that's sort of another story. But with the water that came through on this occasion, the volume was enormous. It persisted for an extended period of time. And even as the floodwaters receded, there were just no resources or facilities to dry those materials, even if they hadn't been wet for 48 hours. But when something porous is wet, even for 12 hours, bacteria starts to grow. And what we see after 48 hours is mold growing. And certainly in the case of this recent event, those things are just not salvageable. So you've got to take out the interior walls, the insulation, any other porous materials you might find in there, again, the ceiling insulation. You're going to have to really be mindful if you've got a timber frame about drying that frame out. It may need to be the technical term is media blasted. There's a few different ways you can basically take off the surface. Let's call it exfoliation, to exfoliate the surface and then have it resealed. If you've got a steel frame, that's one of the advantages of having a steel frame. You don't have to think about that, and allow the whole thing to dry out before you re-clad everything. That also means things like couches, mattresses, pillows, anything that's upholstered, made of foam, latex, those things are not going to be recoverable either. I'm near Chindera, and there was a lot of low-lying cabins that got flooded, although not to the same height as places like Lismore. And, you know, I saw a post on Facebook of one family who've got a beautiful leather couch that sort of got wet at the bottom, and there just isn't, unless it was dried within 48 hours, it just isn't recoverable.
Hence why we see all the furniture on the streets and everyone's just tossed everything.
Yes, 100%. And it can be very devastating, especially difficult if you're in an area that you couldn't get flood insurance anyway, or you didn't have insurance, or your insurance isn't enough to replace everything. It's very tempting to want to hang on to things. But I do want to caution about that, because keeping those things in your home, if you've remediated the actual home, it's just going to contaminate the area again and is going to be a source of pathogens and toxins in your home so long as it's there. And again, what I've seen time and time again in the 4 years that I've, you know, been impacted by mold myself, and seen, you know, thousands and thousands of people come through the Toxic Mold Support Australia group, is understandably so. And I did this too. I am not perfect. I did this too with some shoes and some books and some smaller items, and people hang on to them and remain unwell and then eventually realize they've actually, once they get rid of them, they come right. And so as heartbreaking as it is, you're going to save yourself more heartbreak if you can let things go that are unrecoverable now. If there's things that are sentimental, like old family photos that you don't have negatives for, or digital copies, there are treatments that can be done, and you can obviously preserve things by encasing them in glass or laminating and things like that. You don't necessarily have to burn everything, but most things aren't going to be worth the expense that, and they won't be the same. Semi-porous things may be recoverable, so depending on how long they were underwater or wet for. So if you had a proper timber table and it hasn't swollen, you may be able to dry that out and recover that. But if you had like an MDF, like behind me, I've got a, you know, an IKEA bookcase, and I love IKEA, but it's, you know, chipboard with plastic laminate on it. It's basically going to swell up in 5 seconds and be unrecoverable. If you've got material made out of that, that's got to go in the bin. The things that you will be able to clean are anything that's not porous. So if it's stainless steel, if it's ceramic, if it's glass or any other kind of metal. So thinking back now to the first grown-up bed I ever bought myself, it was a queen-size four-poster bed that was wrought iron. And so obviously the slats would have had to have been replaced, the wooden slats and the mattress and the pillow, but the actual iron frame itself would have been fine with a clean. Now, the other question I get a lot is, what do you clean? What do you clean with? And what do you clean mold with? Now, with the flooding, there's another layer of microbial contamination to think about, not just because the floodwaters picked up all kinds of runoff, but also there was sewage in there and it was standing water for some time as well. It took a long time for the water to go down. We don't typically recommend biocides or antimicrobial sprays and soaps and things when cleaning mold generally, because if it's recoverable, a damp microfiber cloth is all you need. But with bacteria and sewage and all that other sort of stuff, I would be, if it was me personally, using a damp microfiber cloth, so a bucket of hot water, maybe with a bit of dish soap, some white vinegar and some clove oil. If you don't have clove, you could use tea tree or eucalyptus. But please know that you can really only do that on surfaces that are glass and metal and ceramic, like crockery and cutlery would be okay, and pots and pans and things like that, but not things that were, you know, semi-porous or porous. Those things you just can't get the mold out of it or the bacteria.
So even like solid timber,
you don't use, pardon?
Even solid timber things.
So timber is an interesting one. There's various grades of timber, and if it was solid timber and it was laminated or it was sealed and seasoned and treated with like waxes and oils, trees have a natural hygroscopic property, and different timbers have different abilities to take on moisture and then release it. For example, cedar, the reason they use it in saunas is it's very, very hygroscopic. It's able to absorb a lot of moisture and then release it. And the natural resins in the timber have an antimicrobial effect and resist mold and bacteria from growing. So if it isn't swollen in any way and you dry it as soon as you humanly possible, just keep an eye on it. If anything starts to grow on it, then you will have to throw that out. In some cases, a good sandback can take down the layer of wood that got damp and take it back to a dry timber, and then you can reseal it. Maybe recoverable, especially if you've got like a precious family heirloom or an antique or something that you're really attached to. But that's one of those things you'd want to get a professional to make a call on to avoid getting sick. And that's quite tricky. Should we talk about finding a professional to assess your things?
Yeah, definitely.
So there's an awful lot of professions that offer mold testing services. However, most of those don't approach it from a health point of view. Often it's a structural or a cosmetic point of view, or the lens of health that they look through is quite a limited one. And so the gold standard, in my opinion, is getting a certified mold testing technician who trained through the Coles College, ACES, or a building biologist who that was part of their training, because it's a unit that's actually part of the building biology training now, out to actually assess the property. Now, in some cases that might not be feasible. For example, we've got two in the Northern Rivers and we've got, you know, thousands and thousands of homes. So you'd be on a long waiting list for an in-person thing. That being said, a lot of building biologists and mold testing technicians do offer online consultations. I also do that. And they can either tell you straight away, just from your description, that's just not going to work. Or here's how much it would cost to test it. Here's how you do the test. I'll arrange the test kit to be sent to you. I'll guide you how to do it, and we can interpret the results and work it out. So you can always do an online consult if you need to. Knowing that's going to really help you to determine what can be remediated and what can't, and then also what would constitute appropriate remediation for that item. Now, when it comes to remediation, again, the gold standard is IICRC certification, and we'll put both of the links in the show notes for that, how to find a building biologist and how to find a remediator. But they have got a page on their website where you can just pop your postcode in, and it'll show you all of the certified companies in your area. Also double check that the person coming to do the remediation is certified themselves, or at least is committed to adhering to the standards that the IICRC have set. And then you know that your whatever you're getting remediated, which you're obviously paying for or insurance is paying for, is going to be done appropriately and isn't going to cause you health problems down the line.
Okay, so we'll make sure that we pop those suggestions into the show notes so that people can follow that, because it's definitely necessary to try and reach out and do it professionally and properly, so that people don't have that exposure. There's no shortcuts, I believe, to this mold stuff. So you're saying you have to gut the house. You unfortunately let go of those possessions that you might love so much, or find a way, if they are, you know, family items or whatnot, to safely keep them, and then bring in the professionals to try and identify where the exposure is, if it's still there, and then sort of put your house back together, really, is summarizing. Yeah, it's huge, isn't it? Yeah. It's big. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and there's so many people that are going to have to go through that. So
yeah,
it's a tough subject, isn't it?
Can I just add one thing there? Just from what I've seen, there's a few ways you can approach it. For some people, you can sort of gut the house and try and get it insulated and internally clad as quickly as possible once everything is dry, and then just piecemeal put your house back together. You're far better off sleeping on an air mattress than trying to sleep on a damp, moldy mattress. Not that this is the same example, but I know when I bought my apartment as a young lady, I slept on a camping chair. I slept on a camping bed, sorry, and I had a camp chair. I had one steak knife and I had an esky bin with ice. Couldn't afford a fridge. And that's how I got started. And if I was in the same position again today, I would happily go back to the absolute bare bones of what I need than get sick again. What I will also say, though, is, you know, for some people, if you don't have children or pets and you have a vehicle that's not moldy, some people have lived in their van, lived in a bus, but what I have found is most common is people will actually end up living in a tent in the backyard or in someone else's yard until they can piece things together. And I know none of those options sound appealing at all. But I share them because for people who've been affected by toxic mold in other ways, this has been their pathway to healing. And I'm pointing it out because from what I see with chronic toxic mold exposure is people can become so unwell, they're too sick to work, and then they don't have the money to actually fix anything or do anything, and they end up in this position eventually. And so I'm just laying those options out there to help people think laterally for now until we get better support, better options and more resources. Obviously you could stay with friends, you could find somewhere else, there's all kinds of things, but if you're in a jammed between a rock and a hard place and you don't have any of those other more suitable options, you know, those are things that people have done and have managed to then allow themselves to recover or accumulate resources to kind of get back on their feet as well.
Prevention is better than the treatment, and I totally get what you're saying there. Bit of a prophylactic approach. So yeah, I know there was a lot of people like Woodburn, for example, they're doing a tent city down there, and there was a lot of tents happening. So hopefully that's what people are doing, is trying to, you know, find out what's going on in their home, what needs to be done before moving back into it. And yeah. I think sadly it's the option that needs to be considered right now to prevent the ill health effects later on. Can we perhaps just touch very quickly? I know I'm very mindful of time, and maybe I'll split this into two podcasts depending on how long we go, but water, because gastro is happening. A lot of people are getting sick. There's a lot of people obviously having bottled water because of the donations and they didn't have the water. But what can people do to, you know, just try and clean up their water a little bit at the moment?
So one of the challenges, one of the many challenges that this whole region has experienced is obviously contaminated water supply with all kinds of contaminants, actually, but including sewage. So we've got, you know, human pathogens in the drinking water. So first of all, I mean, it's a hierarchy of priorities. So first of all, we don't want anyone getting sick with acute illness, because that's the last thing you need on top of everything else. So if you don't have access to bottled water or a clean water supply, boiling your water is going to be at least the bare minimum. I would be recommending to kill off any bacteria that might be in there, and that way you're not going to get gastro or any other sort of bacteria or waterborne illnesses as a result. The other aspect to that, just quickly, is ensuring that you're protected as much as possible as you clean up. So two things I want to say about that. Number one, appropriate footwear. Again, there, if you're not here or you haven't come down and had a look like you did, it's very, even so, I live here and I've done some driving around as well, and, you know, and helping out, and it's, the magnitude of it is actually incomprehensible. So when I say you should wear appropriate footwear, ideally gumboots, I mean, where do you just drum up like 20,000 gumboots out of nowhere? This isn't going to be feasible for everyone. But if you have gumboots, rubber boots, waterproof boots, or other sort of workwear boots, so you can avoid getting cuts on your feet and having the pathogens or bacteria coming in that way, that would be really important. I had a client a long time ago who developed Crohn's disease as a result of cutting his finger while cleaning a septic tank. And it set up gastro, I think, like overnight, that then just got worse and worse and then turned into Crohn's disease. So it's definitely something you want to be very, very careful about. Otherwise, running shoes, I'm about to donate a pair, you know, that can it can be trashed. You know, just don't wear, obviously don't do bare feet, don't do thongs. Wear some kind of footwear if you can to protect that. The other thing is your airway. So again, where do you find 20,000, you know, N95 masks, full face respirators? Like the right masks are very expensive, and of course, just ridiculous for people to purchase who are only going to use it for this. But hopefully masks are a bit easy to come by, given, you know, they were so prolific with COVID. And this is one of those instances where I think their use is worthwhile. What I would say, though, is to make sure you've got a nice seal around the face. So that might be a little bit tricky to achieve. The other thing to be mindful of is pathogens can also get in through the eyes. So sunglasses, safety glasses. I mean, if it was me, and I have got a full face respirator, but if I didn't, I'd probably wear swimming goggles to stop the things getting into my eyes. So as you're doing the cleanup, you're not getting things splashing into your mouth and splashing into your eyes as you're doing the work. So yeah, going back to the water thing, boil it at the very least. And if you can, filter it as well, that would be really helpful. Now, what that might look like for you is going to depend on your circumstances and where you are. Like for some people, it might be, and these aren't the best filters in the world, but it might be those in jug filters where they've got the insert, a carbon filter inside. It's not a replacement for boiling water. You do have to do that first, and then let it cool and then run it through the filter into the jug. But that's going to pull out other contaminants that boiling will not. Boiling is just literally getting the microorganism level down. And with the carbon, like I said, with the activated charcoal, it's great for absorbing toxins and also some heavy metals and other pollutants that may have made its way into the water. If you are back in your home, you might already have a water filter. If you don't, you can set up a countertop, benchtop system for $150. Again, it might be an outlay that some people can't manage, but the filters themselves, actually you won't even need that because ours cost that because we got it in Sydney and we needed a fluoride filter. If you're in the Byron region, you won't need the fluoride canister. You'll just need the other one. But the filters themselves last for up to 12 months. And then when you replace them, they're like $50 each. So I think that's a really cost-effective way to get clean, pure water. If you're doing it that way and it's attached to the tap, you're going to reverse the order in which you do things. Whilst those filters do filter out a lot of microorganisms, if there's sewage in the water, I wouldn't be relying on that. I would then be boiling it after it came out of the filter tap itself. If you're in a more remote area, maybe the town supply of water has been interrupted. There are things you can buy from camping stores. I know one of our beautiful colleagues, Helen Patterin, arranged for donations from Life Straw, was fundraising for Life Straw. And Life Straw has a few different products. There's literally a straw that you can kind of put in a creek and drink the water, which is amazing. But they've got other ones which you can fill up the water bottle and the straw sits in there and just filters the water as you're drinking it. There's another one you can collect it in a bag and it sort of works like an IV drip and comes through the filter. So there's a few options, but that would be a top priority in those areas where when you're in the middle of the flood cleanup and have been impacted by flood waters.
Okay. Great points there. I think that'll be really helpful for some people because I think they're just so stressed in that fight and flight mode that they're probably not considering some of these core things that can, you know, really impact. And there is gastro. Like I was at the evacuation center on Saturday and there is a lot of gastro going around on top of COVID. These are some of the things we want to try and mitigate so these guys don't have to deal with illness on top of what they're already dealing with. So thank you for touching on that.
Pleasure.
So Amy, you are available for consultations. You also have a course. Does that go into mold as well? I know you've got an online course. Could you maybe just touch on that and let us know how people can get in contact with you because there will be people that want to reach out. How can we find you and how can we learn more from you on this topic?
Yes, so thank you for asking that. This is a subject that is like just the closest to my heart out of them all after having been through what I went through. And preventing that or helping people navigate that is something that I am really committed to. There's a few things that I have available. So first of all, I do have a free ebook, How Mold Can Make You Sick. And whilst this may not be particularly useful if you're in the midst of flooding, it may be helpful when you come out the other side if you're wondering whether what you're dealing with could be caused by mold. So I will give you the link there. I've also got a webinar coming up in a couple of weeks, which will be recorded. So obviously if you're in the middle of cleaning up, the last thing you want to do is tune into the webinar. But it's 7 subtle signs your home has mold. And I think this one is useful. I've actually created it more for people who, not someone who's been through flooding, but people who like, I wonder if my house does, or I suspect that it does, but I can't see it. How else would I know? What else could I do to test? And I guess for someone who maybe wasn't impacted by floodwaters too badly and maybe hasn't sort of remediated to the nth degree, this would be sort of a good way of maybe just checking in. As to whether or not this is an issue. So please know if you register for that, you don't have to show up live. You can watch the replay later, although you get to ask me questions live. So if it works for you, please jump on. But the course that I've created is called Mold Proof Your Home. And it's really for anyone who wants to have the healthiest home possible, but it's really teaching people the ways in which we occupy our homes and accidentally make our house moldy. And we all do it. I didn't know some of the things that I was doing that were problematic, like going to bed with wet hair, for instance, or having a shower and throwing open the bathroom door to let the steam out quicker so I could use the mirror. Mm. And all I'm doing is throwing water into the rest of my house. There's lots of mistakes that I made and obviously learnt through my training. And it's really designed to help people understand how to prevent mold from happening in their home. But also it goes into great detail around what constitutes a proper assessment of the home and appropriate remediation. And that could be really helpful for anyone who's had been through the flood, but also anyone who's maybe had water leaks in the past and maybe it wasn't actually fixed properly and now they know the difference, or maybe they've just had one and they want to know like what questions to ask the assessor and what a proper scope of work should look like. So, you know, obviously from listening to this podcast, people will now know someone who comes in and sprays something around ain't it, but like what does that look like, you know, in a more detailed manner. So, yeah, I don't know how helpful it's going to be for anyone who's impacted by flooding. Obviously, there's nothing you can do to prevent a natural disaster like that. And the thing has to unfold and the steps that are taken are just a result of the constraints of the circumstances. But I feel like this experience, because we've had flooding in Queensland as well, we've had flooding in Victoria, we've had flooding in Sydney, I feel like mold is on people's radars more than it's ever been, thank goodness. And going forward, being able to manage things and prevent things, I'd really like to help people avoid ever having health problems from mold again.
Yeah, prevention is key. And, yeah, there's so much that can be done to prevent and also to mitigate if they are already exposed. And you've given us some, you know, really key points there for people to hopefully take on board and start applying right now if they can. Amy, I believe also for the practitioners listening, did you do a SERS symposium a few years ago with bioceuticals as well? That's also available. You've done some things out there in the naturopathic world. Do you want to share a couple of those things in case practitioners are going, I need to learn more, I need to get savvy with this, this is the time?
Yeah, absolutely. I will just double check if it's still available.
I think
I'm
pretty
sure it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So one of my, as I've already said, my mission is to just prevent as many people going through this as possible. And as a clinician who I considered myself very well educated and really had absolutely no idea about this area, I created a professional training for clinicians, so it's available to any health professional, so GPs, naturopaths, herbalists, nutritionists, and even a pharmacist could do it if they wanted to. But it's a comprehensive training that includes how to recognize mold illness, how to diagnose it, what tests to run, what labs to use, the 12-step process for healing both the allopathic version and the naturopathic version, and where they can really complement each other. It also has a whole module on building biology assessment, so mold testing and also remediation. It really is a one-stop shop to learn everything you could possibly want to know about SERS, how to treat it, how to recognize it. There's even a module on the secondary complications that can happen. And if anyone listening has been exposed to mold for an extended period of time, you might recognize some of these. But when people are exposed to poison chronically and their immune system is chronically triggered, we can see multiple chemical sensitivity developing. We can also see mast cell activation syndrome, so histamine allergy problems, multiple food intolerances and intolerances to EMFs, and also issues with the autonomic nervous system, things like POTS, where, you know, if people stand up and their blood pressure drops, the heart, you know, the heart will race, they'll get tachycardia. So I go into those secondary elements as well, because sometimes that's what someone will see a clinician for. They might not say to you, I get muscle cramps and I get headaches and I feel dizzy and I feel sick, but I have multiple chemical sensitivity. And they might even blame the those other symptoms on chemical sensitivity when it's actually, you know, a symptom of things rather than the cause. So if you are a clinician listening to this and you're ready to to learn about this whole other world that wasn't covered in college anywhere, and still isn't at this stage, this is the place to go. You can also go to the US and train with Richie Shoemaker yourself, but it costs a lot more and it's a lot more hassle. So, you know, I know what I'd pick.
Yeah, and I think the practitioners around, you know, the Southeast Queensland, Northern Rivers, they're probably going to have to get up to scratch with this because we're going to start seeing a lot of eating clinic.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, and I'm available for mentoring if anyone is needs that, because it is quite a daunting prospect when you first start, but something that, you know, will just revolutionise your patient's health too, because this is an area that's high humidity, it's prone to a lot of rainfall at certain times of the year, and this isn't an issue that is limited to people who've been flooded. It is very common. In fact, statistically speaking, from what I can tell, we have roughly the same occurrence of water damaged buildings as the US, which means every second home and or office is water damaged. And I can tell you from when I was house hunting in Sydney, trying to find a safe home after I got sick, I looked at 300 homes and 295 of them were visibly water damaged, aka moldy. And scary thing is, most of the time it's not obvious, it's not visible, either because it's been painted over, covered up, or it's actually trapped in the wall spaces and the ceiling cavity, and you can't immediately, you know, register that it's there. So I feel like this is a missing link for a lot of people in terms of their general health and well-being and conditions, but also right now with everyone being impacted by the mold from the flood, there's going to be a really big demand, and people are going to need help.
Absolutely. So we mentioned the CERS training with the bioceuticals. Where can our other listeners find you for your courses, to book a consultation? What's your website and what are your details that we can reach out to you on?
Yes, so my website is whatthenaturopathsaid.com. I don't yet have the details of the course up there because I'm still building it, but you can send me a little message through there if you like. Otherwise, probably the easiest way is to connect with me on Instagram. My handle there is thatnaturopath, and I will be sharing the details of the course in the next week or so. So you can certainly get your name on the list then as well.
Okay, when you release that, I'll just add that into the show notes.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you so much. I know it's been a short notice and a big topic. And like I said, I'm probably going to split this into two podcast episodes so people can really digest it and replay it easily. Are there any last pearls of wisdom that you want to leave us with before we wrap it up today, Amy?
I guess the last thing I'll say is, as someone who was made really sick by mold and thought my health would never recover, and my life would never recover, and my life was ruined, I can tell you there is light at the end of the tunnel. There is a well-worn path to getting things fixed, both in terms of your possessions and property as well as your health. And really the key here is to take really good care of yourself in all of those micro moments so that you can just keep putting one foot in front of the other, because your healing is inevitable. This will be resolved eventually. And it's just about, you know, really supporting yourself on the way through that journey. And as you mentioned, there are a number of roaming clinics and freely available natural health and holistic health services in the Northern Rivers at the moment. If you come to any in this area, you might meet me. And, you know, take advantage of that. There have been some incredibly generous donations, and just get the support that you need. Suffering, you don't have to suffer through the whole thing. There is a lot that can be done just to help you get through that initial cleanup crisis mode and then pull you forward into the next chapter of your life as well.
Yeah, well said. Take it one step at a time. And we'll make sure that we put all the show notes, everything we've mentioned, all the information that we shared into the show notes so that it's easily accessible from those surveys to where to find things to your course. So go and check that out, guys, and hopefully that's some good insight and a good guide on where to start with things. So once again, Amy, thank you so much.
Thank you, Sandy.
Thank you for listening. I have been a practitioner of naturopathic and Chinese medicine for over a decade. I have a master's degree of health science and I am an academic lecturer at Australia's leading natural medicine college. I am available worldwide online for bookings. Simply go to sandyrosshealth.com.